Hello, and welcome to Changes, a new program from Chief Healthcare Executive. In this program, we're going to be featuring conversations with healthcare leaders about the rapid changes in hospitals and the healthcare industry. We'll look at changes in government policy, new advances in technology, and just the general evolution of the industry. And I think we've got the perfect guest for our first show. We're talking with Shomi Saha, a leading healthcare expert whose familiar face is panelist at many healthcare conferences. She's a pharmacist, a lawyer with deep experience in government policy and advocacy. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ron. Really excited to be here today.
Well, thanks for doing this. And let's just dive in. Just kind of a general question, might even be a strange place to start, but just as a place to begin, there've been just enormous changes the Trump administration has brought in since taking office a little over a year ago. Just in terms of the pace of change coming out of Washington, is this more accelerated than we've seen in the past from your perspective?
Yes, I think one thing you need to know about a Trump administration is that it is never boring. The key is that everything that is happening is known. They tell you what they're going to do. So, what is happening isn't the challenge. The challenge, however, is the speed at which that change is happening. And coupled with that speed is oftentimes that whiplash effect that we see where something is true today, not true tomorrow, back to being true 72 hours from now. And so I think that's the biggest challenge is how do you just keep up with the multitude of change that is all coming at the same time? And how do you prioritize within that mound of change as far as what do you need to focus your time and energy on today versus what may be able to sit on the back burner for a little bit?
And it feels like, at least from the healthcare leaders I've talked to, that they are definitely struggling to keep up with those changes. And not even so much talking from a partisan perspective, but just trying to understand, 'cause like you said, with tariff policies, for instance, and some other policies too, what might be the direction today is not necessarily the direction a week from now or even a few days from now. So do you feel like that's been a struggle for healthcare organizations to sort of make sense and keep up?
Absolutely. And oftentimes the lack of detail is also really frustrating for healthcare leaders. So, for example, this is an administration where a lot of policy is announced via social media, which may be appropriate given just where we are in the 21st century and how important of a role social media plays. But oftentimes what you do see is a social media post and no additional details. And so you are left to try to figure out and discern what does that really mean. And a lot of tariff policy, unfortunately, has come forward from social media posts. So you see this frenzy occur where you see a social media post that says 100% tariff from this country starting this date. And immediately, any healthcare leader is going to go directly to their CFOs, their supply chain leaders, and say, let's try to figure out the impact. But then you have questions such as, are pharmaceuticals included? What about generics? What about this? What about that? And that lack of detail makes it very difficult to understand the true impact.
I love the way you described the way the releases come out on like social media, like on X or some other platform too. And just even as a journalist, and especially for healthcare organizations, you know, in the past it's usually been a press release, and often it's like you'll get the what is called the embargoed release in the industry, where like you know, tomorrow we're going to be releasing this new policy. Here's some background, so like industry leaders, journalists, everybody has a chance to sort of keep up with that. With this, it's just, here's a post at 5 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon on X,
And
and
sometimes it's at midnight or in the middle of the evening. And so, yeah, normal business hours do not matter anymore.
But at least, I mean, the social media aspect does make sense, especially with the administration, the current occupant of the Oval Office being very active in social media. So I think there's value in making sure everyday folks can see these policies too. I think where healthcare leaders would love is at least maybe a little notice, and also, as you said, some explanation about the policies as well.
I mean, some positive is that there is a level of transparency and visibility into the thought-making process, which you don't always get with most administrations. So there is some positive to see the back and forth. It's just that that back and forth typically happens within the boardroom and doesn't leave the boardroom. So you're seeing a lot of that decision-making occur in real time in these situations.
Well, with the passage of H.R. 1, it began as a big tax package, ended up being a pretty big healthcare policy piece of legislation as well, with a big change to Medicaid, the projected cuts of $1 trillion for the next decade, and millions expected to lose coverage. How much of an impact is this going to have on hospitals and really the delivery of healthcare?
I think it's going to have a huge impact. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that most of the provisions of HR 1 do not go into effect for a few more years. So initially, a lot of healthcare leaders kind of thought, you know what? I don't have to worry about this. 2028, maybe I'll start thinking about it. And there was an assumption that a lot of this may be overturned by future administrations, or if Congress were to turn and flip in the midterm elections, or that Congress would never allow this to go into effect, similar to how DSH cuts have been delayed year over year. I think there's a couple challenges here. We're talking $1 trillion over 10 years. Delaying DSH cuts is about $8 billion a year, and it's relatively easy to come up with $8 billion in offsets to make that happen. You're talking $100 billion a year in offsets here, and that's nearly impossible to come up with that dollar amount. And nobody in healthcare has a good idea on how you could offset that vast number. And the reality is the mantra in DC still exists that healthcare cuts have to pay for healthcare innovation. And so we're not seeking dollars from other industries or elsewhere to make that happen. I think the other reality and, a big message to healthcare leaders is, yes, most of these cuts do not go into effect for 2 years. However, if you do not start preparing now for the inevitable, you will be left behind. And so that is where you're seeing a lot of leaders really start thinking through service line rationalization, which is a very fancy way of saying what services make money and what services do not make money. And as someone who has maternal health as a huge passion project of mine, one of the first services to close is typically maternity wards because they don't make money. So you're starting to see that happen. You're starting to see healthcare leaders really look at how they decrease their non-labor spend as much as possible. Anybody who's on that cusp of having a positive margin is really trying to push forward on how to get to a positive margin in anticipation of this. But I think in general, the biggest concern is more uninsured individuals, so higher uncompensated care. And what does this mean from a crowding of the emergency departments moving forward? And what does it mean from a staff burnout perspective as well? And I will say, I think from my perspective, the biggest concern is that a lot of folks think that cuts to healthcare ended with HR 1. I think they only began with HR 1. I think there are so many more things that are still being discussed. Site neutral payment policies, for example, potential changes to the 340B program. The reality is that healthcare went from being heroes 6 years ago to being zero. And there isn't anybody in DC that's raising their hand and talking about how they need to save hospitals and how they need to save the healthcare infrastructure. Which begs the question, is it too big to fail? Are we going to allow hospitals to fail? Are we going to have to bail them out? I don't think we're there yet as far as having that conversation, but we're pretty close.
It feels like hospitals have lost some clout in Washington over the last couple of years. Is that overstating it, or is that a fair perspective?
Oh, I think it's an absolutely fair perspective. I think the challenge when you talk to lawmakers is they each have a lot of individual respect for the hospitals in their constituency. But at the same time, they ask a lot of questions as to, well, my hospital is telling me that they're struggling financially, but every time I drive by, they're building something fancy and new. Or my hospital is telling me that they're struggling financially, but then they just bought naming rights to a stadium or Super Bowl ads or whatnot. So what is really happening here? And it's created an immense level of distrust moving forward. And so a lot of lawmakers do believe that hospitals are not being honest about their financial situation. Or you go to conferences, investor conferences, and these hospitals are talking about their negative margin, but their multi-billion dollar venture arm in the same conversation. And so, what is real? And so, my biggest piece of advice is always be as you wish to appear. You have to be honest about what is real, and you can't expect that lawmakers won't see through that smoke and mirrors. And that's the biggest challenge that I think hospitals have is just perception. Part two is this administration is running the government like a business. They want people to come to the negotiation table and they want folks to negotiate. And you're seeing that in healthcare. You're seeing the payers come to the table and negotiate. You're obviously seeing the pharmaceutical manufacturers come to the table and negotiate. You've even seen the IT companies and vendors come to the table and negotiate. You haven't seen hospitals come to the table to negotiate yet. And so that is also holding them back, is that they're just not part of the conversation right now with the administration.
I've seen a number of hospitals and healthcare leaders I've spoken to are looking now, even though Medicaid cuts are still coming, but they're taking steps now. Some are looking at services, like you said, maybe cutting back some services where maybe there's a competitor in the market that's offering some service. So they can let that go. Some systems have done fairly substantial layoffs already, and they've cited HR1 as one of the prime reasons. But then there are others that, like you said, are looking down the road thinking maybe Congress will make a change, maybe even by 2028 with a new occupant in the Oval Office, there might be some change. It feels like there's some that are kind of banking on change coming. And I think the concern I have and some others might have is that hope is not a tactic. So is that sort of what you see too, that some people are just sort of hoping for the best, for want of a better phrase?
Yes, I think it's absolutely the case. And what you're seeing is a lot of it depends on the size of the system, right? Many are able to invest in AI and technology to become leaner and more efficient and help decrease some of their overhead costs. But from a healthcare perspective, you're either buying or building those assets. And so my concern is that you're going to have rural hospitals, small community independent hospitals, and other small providers that are left behind just because they don't have the capital necessary to invest in that manner. And then that begs the question about M&A and consolidation in the hospital industry. And I think you're seeing two different extremes. You're seeing a lot of the small independent guys get gobbled up because they can't afford to operate independently anymore. But at the same time, you're seeing some of the largest health systems in the country actually dissolve and start selling off assets because they realize that getting so large can also be problematic from an infrastructure, compliance, state regulatory requirement perspective. And so I think a lot of folks are trying to figure out what the right size is so that you can truly create those efficiencies, help decrease costs, and still have control over improving quality and safety, which should be the most important thing.
Yeah, and we've seen some larger systems exiting markets where maybe they're not the biggest player, and just also as they look to sort of right size to meet their needs a little bit better too. So I think it's going to be interesting to see if there's more mergers. I know a lot of analysts are expecting more mergers to unfold, especially maybe with some financially distressed systems feeling like they need a partner to stay afloat. But it also one makes me wonder how many systems might be looking to expand, but also maybe seeing the cuts come in Medicaid, maybe they're not pursuing some of the expansion they might normally have in the past.
Right. And I think if I was a health system leader right now and I was thinking about the impact of HR1, I'd be looking at more financially viable states to expand into versus states that I know have a huge delta in their Medicaid programs that aren't going to be able to help supplement some of the decrease in federal funding, because that is an option. Some of the states can step up to the plate and help offset some of those decreases. So if you're looking into potentially expanding into a state where there's no way that that state can help offset some of those Medicaid deficits, perhaps that's not your best bet right now.
I wanted to go back to what you talked about with maternal health, because obviously a big problem in this country. We've got disturbing, frankly, chilling maternal mortality rates. And the March of Dimes said there's over a third of the U.S. counties are basically maternity healthcare deserts. And with the cuts in Medicaid coming, this seems like an area, as you already mentioned, that a lot of health systems might be looking to scale back in. So how worried about are you about maternal health, which already needs more support, maybe taking more hits in the near future?
I mean, I'm terribly concerned. I just survived my first high-risk pregnancy. I'm currently in the midst of my second very high-risk pregnancy. And I can just tell you a bit of a personal story. I was It took me a long time to find a maternal fetal medicine physician that I was comfortable with, that would actually listen to me, that would was okay with me coming in with legitimately a PowerPoint presentation of all of the data that I had run to figure out what my certain risk factors were and to take me seriously. But I was also able to deliver at a hospital where I knew the CEO. I could have a conversation with them. I could look them in the eye, and I was able to say, "You're going to make sure that I walk out of here with my child healthy." And my biggest goal is that all birthing parents and all providers have access to that level of data and that level of individualized care moving forward. And that every birthing parent has the ability to find a provider who's willing to listen to them and listen, willing to hear them when they tell them that something's not right and that they need to look at things differently. I had also run the numbers between looking at different zip codes of where I could potentially deliver. And it was astonishing what the numbers said, or even trying to make sure that I had access to a level three NICU just in case. So, that's my biggest goal. I think we really need to start thinking differently about the maternal care experience ending with the birthing event. And really not need to start thinking about postnatal care very similarly to how we think about prenatal care. And so you've seen a lot of states expand Medicaid coverage for 12 months postpartum, and we don't necessarily have a ton of data yet as to whether or not that is helping decrease maternal morbidity and mortality. But what we do know is that mortality and morbidity in the hospital has decreased. What happens after you leave the hospital continues to be the biggest challenge. So I think there's a huge opportunity for CMS, even through the Innovation Center, to look at some value-based care models potentially that look more at the post-delivery experience and reward plans and providers for positive outcomes 12 plus months post-delivery so that it's not just leave the hospital and you're good to go. But there is so much more to do here. It's not just data. It's about how we educate providers, how we educate parents and others, and how we empower folks to speak up.
First of all, congratulations on baby number two on the way.
you.
But you bring up so many important points about being, I mean, you're able to advocate for yourself and you've got obviously knowledge of the healthcare system. I go back to that amazing essay that Serena Williams wrote a few years ago, where she journaled her problems she had getting people to listen when she knew stuff was wrong. And you figure one of the most famous, wealthy women in America. If she's having trouble being heard, this is probably indicative of a bigger problem nationwide. So, I mean, it feels like there's stuff like technology that has to be employed, maybe more telesolutions, but also th there needs to be a rethink of how physicians, providers, health systems are making sure that they're listening to their patients.
1,000%. And I don't know if this is where there's a great role for agentic AI or I'm sorry, ambient AI in the delivery room or in some of those prenatal appointments to be a better listener and help draw out some of those challenges that may have gone unheard that need to be brought to the forefront. Although I don't know that every woman would want ambient AI in the delivery room, that could be challenging as well. But there are roles for technology. And I think this is also a bigger conversation in healthcare. We've moved so much into a population health model, right? Where you treat outliers, but the majority of folks are treated as a cohort, if you will. And that's what guidelines are for. But I think maternal health is a great example of where we need to start doing more individualized, personalized medicine and come back to that being core of who we are and what we do. And I think, again, that's where some value-based care models could potentially be beneficial, where we're not looking at the 15-minute clock and we're not paying based upon volume, we're paying based upon outcomes.
There we are covering so much ground, and it makes me wonder about AI. And you mentioned it with ambient documentation. This seems like an area where there's some genuine enthusiasm. Is this an area where you feel like AI is really having some benefits for doctors and nurses and health systems?
Yeah, I'm hearing wonderful things from healthcare providers that are leveraging ambient AI as far as the level of information that it's capturing, its ability to document, its ability to get the provider back in front of the patient and be part of the listening versus the dictation and typing constantly. So I do think it definitely has a role. It's going to be interesting to see as more data is gathered around the actual benefits and outcomes, how we're measuring the ROI on its implementation, and is it truly helping us create better and safer care for our patients? Back to maternal health, for example, I didn't realize that the most undocumented piece of information during a birthing experience is the weight of the child. Somehow, oftentimes, does not get documented in the chart. And then you don't know if that child is thriving or not in post visits because you don't know what the starting weight was. I can promise you that every mother knows how much that baby weighed when it was born. But that's a simple role for ambient AI to pick that up and auto document that.
My kiddo is 19. I can tell you he was 6 pounds, 8 ounces when he was born.
Exactly, right? Every birthing parent knows what that weight was, but somehow providers are missing that level of documentation because there's so much going on in the room at the time.
That's wild. That's something I never would have imagined to be the least documented item there. I wanted to ask about prior authorization. Obviously, big concerns for a lot of hospitals and health systems. Do you see any progress coming in this area?
I hope so. So in 2025, the payers with HHS did succumb to a voluntary pledge where they promised that they'll do better on prior authorizations, as well as denials and delays. Now, proof is going to be in the pudding as far as how they hold themselves accountable to that pledge, and promises don't always equate to accountability. So I think that is something that is very top of mind for hospitals. This is also an area where it's going to be interesting to see who wins the AI race because you have competing priorities here where hospitals are looking to leverage AI to help file cleaner claims and, help get more real-time prior authorization type of approvals, where you also have payers looking at potentially leveraging AI to help with their claims processing systems, not necessarily deny care per se, but how did those two kind of competing factors come together? And how do we ensure that the patient doesn't get lost at the end of the day in that shuffle?
When Dr. Oz was meeting with the Senate on his way to becoming the administrator of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, he was talking about AI potentially being a real plus in solving some of the headaches with prior authorization. And what he said, I think, would make sense to a lot of people. Like AI can really take there's the bulk of claims that you know are going to get approved that aren't controversial or high risk or high cost. The AI should be taking care of those claims. So you're really only looking at a smaller number of claims where maybe there needs to be more thoughtful review about whether this is necessary, whether there might be a better alternative. So, is that potentially a remedy for this?
Can be. And the administration is also really looking at how AI can be leveraged to help decrease waste, fraud, and abuse. So they have something called the WISER model that is really looking at leveraging AI to help identify some of the fraudulent or wasteful activity, skin substitutes, catheters, items like that. And then what's next? Those are the ones that we're aware of. So yes, I think AI obviously has a role for good, and AI also has a role for bad. And the more that we can push it towards that good, and especially for those administrative functions, to your point, that are the no-brainers, that are easy ones, that we shouldn't be leveraging man hours because it's something simple and should be easily approved, or where you can actually articulate what the approval pathway algorithm should be so that as long as you meet that pathway, you can get an auto approval. I think that's fine. I think the biggest concern is when AI is used for not good. The key is how do you define not good in healthcare?
We've been talking for a little while now, and I know we've got to wrap up soon, but let's stick with AI for just a little bit. The Trump administration's obviously been very pro AI, and they've been encouraging states, hospitals, businesses to accelerate their use of AI. How do you think it's going to play out, especially in healthcare? I mean, there's a lot of pushing ahead for innovation. There's some say we need more guardrails. How do you think the administration can approach AI, and what should health systems be thinking about with the use of AI?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest concern with leveraging AI in healthcare is the lack of a federal framework for how to deploy it. What does good look like? What does liability look like with the use of AI moving forward? And what does the risk matrix look like? There's a very different risk matrix when you're talking about an administrative billing function versus potentially being at the point of care and making a clinical decision or recommending a clinical decision. So that, and I think the proliferation of a state patchwork continues to be a major concern for healthcare to try to navigate. It's going to be impossible for folks to try to navigate a 50 plus state patchwork of AI laws, and that can really stifle innovation and potentially lead to the US actually losing the AI arms race globally. So, step one, healthcare is begging for a framework. You don't often see an industry move forward and say, we would like a framework. Please help us create a framework. So I think you have that. I think having some clarity that NIST will likely be the body that's going to be moving forward with creating that framework is helpful. Just get some level of clarity there that the administration has provided. But the biggest question is when? And are we going to miss our opportunity to really create that framework and regulate AI in a way that's meaningful? Because we missed that opportunity with social media. We missed that opportunity with the internet. And so AI is not going to slow down. So, how do you create guardrails that are federal, create a national framework, alleviate the state patchwork of headache, but also provide enough flexibility to ensure that we can work with HIPAA. HIPAA already exists in healthcare, right? And it's already complicated. So we can't forget that there's already a healthcare framework, which means that any AI framework in healthcare is going to have to be healthcare specific. We can't go with a one size fits all type of approach to all AI regulation because we know healthcare is unique and different. I think the other biggest thing is how are you going to get paid? One, how do you prove that it's working and it's beneficial? And how are you getting paid for implementing these things? It's, we still haven't figured out how to pay for SaaS, let alone how to pay for AI from a CMS perspective. So those are ongoing questions as well.
Well, it's a rapidly changing industry, and AI is right at the forefront of it. And these are certainly issues we're going to be watching in the months to come for sure. But it looks like this was indeed the absolute right guest for joining us for the debut episode of Changes. So Shomi, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Really appreciate the conversation.
Of course. Thank you so much, Ron.